the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview from peterbcollins.com. In a moment, I'll be joined by Andrew J. Basevich. He's a retired Army colonel, a retired professor of history from Boston University, and a sharp critic of American military and foreign policy, especially focused on Syria and Iraq. There's a lot we'll talk about, and I'll give you a formal biography as I introduce him in a moment. But I want to mention here that one thing that Andrew Basevich is uncomfortable talking about is that one of his sons served in Iraq and lost his life there. And I think it really helps us understand the true credibility that Andrew Basevich brings to his commentary on these issues. Before we get started, I want to thank Gary Batterson, John Dickerson, Marianne Razzo, and Joey Perillo. They're all monthly subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast, and I couldn't do it without your support. If you're not currently a subscriber, join in. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. In the upper right corner on the homepage, you click the menu button. Next, you click Become a Subscriber, and you get to choose the level that you're comfortable with. $5, $10, $20 a month, $50 a year. You can make a one-time contribution of any amount via PayPal or mail in a check to the P.O. box that's listed on that page. And don't forget, we've got the iPhone iPad app available for under $3 in the App Store at Apple. And very soon, we will have an Android platform where you can listen to the Peter B. Collins podcast.
What are we fighting for? What am I trying to restore?
Andrew J. Basevich returns to the Peter B. Collins Show today. He served in the U.S. military in Vietnam, later in the First Gulf War, rose to the rank of colonel. He also carries the title of professor from his years at Boston University, where he is now emeritus status. And he is the author of some important books, most recently Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country, and Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. And he has published some important commentaries recently that I want to catch up with him about today. Colonel, Professor, thanks for being with me.
Well, I'm glad to be with you.
I really appreciate your perspective. You're a self-described Catholic conservative. You have a strong military background. And for me, you have deep credibility as an analyst and critic of America's current foreign and military policies. Let me start with an essay that you published in the Boston Globe November 14th, just 24 hours after the Friday the 13th attacks in Paris. And you counseled against the very action that President Hollande engaged in within 48 hours of the brutal assault on Paris. Tell our listeners what your argument is that the U.S. and its allies in the West really have no viable options in trying to influence the outcome of the civil war in Syria.
Well, I don't know that we don't have any viable options, but I think that the President Hollande's immediate response to the Paris attacks was an emotional response, and one can understand that. One can understand the emotions that that attack elicited, but emotions not a particularly good basis for policy. So he said, right out of the chute, that he was, that France was embarking upon what he called, at least in the English translation, pitiless war. And he was then asking for France's allies to join him. And the problem, among the problems here, is that France, which was once a great military power, no longer possesses the ability to wage anything like a serious war independently. So his rhetoric was far out in front of actually existing French capabilities. But beyond that, as much as all of us want to see ISIS defeated, a very large question has to be, for those who favor intervention, well, what happens the day after we achieve that defeat?
Mm-hmm.
The notion that we can, either through air power or through so-called boots on the ground, destroy ISIS and then turn on our heels and simply go home is absurd. We will, the United States will, to the extent that it continues to become involved more deeply, become party to the Syrian civil war. It will once again assume responsibilities for the security of Iraq. So for those who want to go in and get ISIS, and I can understand that sentiment, they need to be prepared for a much longer, more costly enterprise, which will inevitably follow.
And Colonel, let me quote from your Boston Globe commentary. It's not as if the outside world hasn't already given pitiless war a try. The Soviet Union spent all of the 1980s attempting to pacify Afghanistan, succeeded only in killing a million or so Afghans while creating an incubator for Islamic radicalism. Beginning in 2003, the United States attempted something similar in Iraq and ended up producing similarly destabilizing results. By the time U.S. troops withdrew in 2011, something like 200,000 Iraqis had died, most of them civilians. Today, Iraq teeters on the brink of disintegration. Perhaps if the Russians had tried harder or the Americans had stayed longer, they might have achieved a more favorable outcome. Yet that qualifies as a theoretical possibility at best. Years of fighting in Afghanistan exhausted the Soviet Union and contributed directly to its subsequent collapse. Years of fighting in Iraq used up whatever let's roll combativeness Americans may have entertained following 9/11. And, Colonel, not only are those really key points, but the U.S. has these twin objectives that really can't be achieved simultaneously. We continue to cling to the desire to see Bashar al-Assad step down as the ruler of Syria. Yet with the backing of the Russians, and in a moment we'll talk about the French new nominal alliance with Russia, the U.S. really has no leverage to push for the removal of Assad, and it begs the question you raised about the day after. What happens if we defeat the Islamic State Daesh and we also find a way to force a political solution that removes Assad? What next? We don't have a clue.
Well, but more to the point, what's likely to happen next is the emergence of an ISIS successor that will probably fly just about the same flag and will resume this certainly mindless campaign of jihad. Remember where ISIS came from. It didn't come out of sort of magically appear overnight.
Right.
ISIS itself is actually a successor to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Al-Qaeda in Iraq came into existence because of the vacuum that we created in Iraq by overthrowing Saddam Hussein. So the unfortunate tendency, I think, after some horrible event, such as the Paris terrorist attack, is for the discussion, the policy discussion, to become narrowed so that we're only focused on this symptom, ISIS, rather than the larger problem, which is widespread dysfunction that is contributing to the further destabilization of the Islamic world. And we should wish to see that instability remedied. we should wish to see some semblance of law and order and decency be restored to that part of the world, but we should have learned by now that dropping bombs or sending in Western troops simply does not advance that objective, and indeed, in many respects, actually is counterproductive. We make things worse rather than making them better by our misuse of military power.
Mm-hmm. That is such an important point, and I really appreciate, again, coming from you. Now, Colonel, as I alluded to, in the past week, French President Hollande has been very busy. He came to Washington to meet with President Obama, and then he went to Moscow to meet with Vladimir Putin. And in Moscow, he struck some sort of an agreement that France and Russia will share intelligence and targeting and work together to attack Daesh in Syria. And to me, this is a very pivotal point because I think it risks a fracture in NATO and Turkey's separate agenda and its shoot down of the Russian fighter complicate these issues even more. But fundamentally, the U.S., I think, is the odd country out in these efforts. And I saw a moment here where President Obama could say, well, look, if France is going to align with Russia, that's it. We're getting out of Syria. Now, I know I'm just daydreaming to say that, but there is some value to the consideration here that the U.S. ought to find a way to exit the scene.
Well, my view is, and has been for quite some time, that my view is that the application of U.S. military power in the region is counterproductive, and therefore our long-term, and I don't mean long-term like 50 years, but long-term 5 years, our long-term objective should be to reverse the militarization of U.S. policy in this region that has occurred over about the last 30, 35 years, to move to a lower military profile and in essence, to hand over the task of restoring stability to powers in the region who actually do have an interest in restoring stability. Now, who am I talking about? I'm talking about Iran. I'm talking about Saudi Arabia. I'm talking about Turkey. I'm talking about Egypt, some lesser states. And, of course, the nations I just ticked off all have it in for one another in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. All these different fissures of Arab versus Persian, of Sunni versus Shia, of republic versus monarchs, they have plenty of reason to be at each other's throats, but I would argue that they have one reason to collaborate, and that reason is that they all wish to maintain the existing state system, more or less, whereas Islamic State is embarked upon an effort to destroy the existing state system and to replace it with this so-called caliphate. Mm-hmm. I don't really think that ISIS has the capability of achieving its aims, but the from our point of view, the most efficient way to ensure that it doesn't achieve those aims is to get these other countries in the region to step up to the plate and do what they need to do, and that is to police their own neighborhood. That's a diplomatic task. It's not a diplomatic task that I would wish to underestimate. I think it's a very difficult one. And quite frankly, probably the most important of those countries that I named in that regard is Iran.
Yeah.
The policy of the U.S. policy of excluding Iran from playing a meaningful role in international politics in that region, dating back to the Iranian Revolution, has turned out to be quite counterproductive. And I don't think there's any chance of establishing anything remotely like an equilibrium of power in the region unless Iran is a player. And I, frankly, I think the Obama administration is conceding that point.
And, Colonel, we've seen John Kerry convene several weekend summits in Vienna. The Iranians have been at the table for those talks, but notably, no Syrians have been there. And Kerry represents that he speaks for the entire Syrian opposition, that, you know, the absolute precondition is that Assad must go. And we've seen Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, a Democrat from Hawaii who served in two tours in Iraq, stand up and say, you know, the goal of taking out Assad is counterproductive to U.S. interests, and we need to put that behind us. But even today, in the sidebar conversations at the Paris Climate Summit, President Obama is sticking to that pivotal point. And I think that is a recipe for failure.
Well, I'm not sure that, I mean, we're into reading tea leaves here. And I'm not sure that the president is as hard over about Assad must go as he was 6 months or a year ago. Maybe I'm misreading the tea leaves. Now, he's not going to come out and publicly say, oh, I changed my mind. You know, we want Assad to remain in power. But my again, this is merely a guess on my part, is that within the administration that there is a clear sense of priorities that says that dealing with ISIS takes precedence over getting rid of Assad.
Mm-hmm.
If they can, if it is possible to put together some kind of a coalition that conclusively defeats ISIS, then it might be time to try to figure out what the end game in Syria is going to be. Secretary Kerry may claim that he speaks or we speak for the Syrian opposition. I think that's absurd. And quite frankly, I'm not sure we have a very good appreciation of what the Syrian opposition consists of,
yeah,
given that it's it is not in itself a unified camp. And there are Islamists who are part of the resistance to Assad, who we wouldn't want to see come to power in Damascus if they were ultimately successful.
Indeed, and when Putin started the movements in Latakia and signaled that Russia was entering the fray, there was a protest letter signed by, I think, 41 different factions. Now, maybe there were multiple signers from one given group or militia. But I was astounded because, you know, I've known that there are a dozen or more various groups that are fighting either against each other or against the Assad government, and they're supported and funded and armed by various groups, including some of the nations you mentioned as possible holders of a solution. And so, this is a very complex cluster of people with varied interests. And, you know, the U.S. brought Turkey in at the end of August, and immediately Erdogan started bombing in his own country to attack, you know, Kurdish groups to help propel his own reelection. And so this has spun so far out of any semblance of control that my view is the U.S. should look for an exit and use it as quickly as possible.
I don't think I'd agree with you that it's spun out of control. There are layers of complexity, so that even where there is two countries may agree on one particular goal, they themselves will then disagree on other goals.
Mm-hmm.
So any sort of a partnership is partial. It's tentative. The partnership itself conceals elements of competition and agreement. So it's not that it's out of control. It is that it is damnably difficult to understand. It's hard even to keep the players straight. And I think it's that then that leads to the temptation on the part of some people to say, well, let's send in the Marines and we'll sort everything out, and that's simply not going to happen. I mean, The Marines may end up going in if we are really stupid, but it won't sort things out. So it's not so much out of control, but it's complex.
Now, what is your view of the president's announcement of an insertion of some 50 special forces operatives yesterday on the 1st of December? Defense Secretary Carter told Congress that there will be more U.S. troops who are going to be frontline advisors, is the way I'd characterize his comments. And so we're seeing a creeping escalation here. The president continues to say no major troop deployments. You've got McCain and Lindsey Graham saying 10 to 20,000 troops immediately. You have Secretary Clinton talking about the fantasy of a no-fly zone. At least it seems fantastical to me, again, given the entry of Russia and the unpredictability of Turkey in the skies over Syria and Iraq. So the president is really cornered in many ways. What would be your counsel to him at this point?
Well, I don't have the intelligence that he has in terms of being able to evaluate whether ISIS is getting stronger or ISIS is getting weaker. I mean, my outsider's perspective says that the sort of mission creep approach that he is taking is unlikely to succeed, but people with access to intelligence may have a better feel. I think the president is in a relatively strong position. I mean, he's not running for re-election, and it's true that anybody involved in partisan politics these days, not anybody, many people, the partisans are beating the war drums because they think that taking that get tough posture, and I include Secretary Clinton here, is a way to win votes. And from a political point of view, they may actually be right. But mm-hmm. I don't think that the president, I'm confident that the president is not going to give in to the demands of people like McCain and Lindsey Graham and send in a large invasion force. I'm not confident that the president's going to avoid any further escalation. I think that, you know, his claim that no Americans are in combat, that's not true.
No, it's not.
I mean, that we have people who are in harm's way on a daily basis, and I'm sure they're getting combat pay, and I'm sure they deserve it.
Well, there's some videos that surfaced from Kurdish fighters demonstrating that U.S. forces were fighting right alongside them, and they claim sometimes in front of them, in April, in July, and in September. So,
that's true.
Yeah, I think
mm-hmm.
it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, given the political dynamics here in the United States, the complicated international picture, what options do you think the president has to try to achieve his stated goal of rolling back Daesh without a commitment of large numbers of American troops?
I mean, people might dismiss me as naive, but I think it is a diplomatic task, and I think the task is one of looking the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Iranians, the Turks in the eyeballs and say, this is your problem. You know, if we can help in some way, we'll be glad to help. But this is your problem. You are the major powers of this region. You are the ones who have the responsibility and, frankly, the primary interest in ensuring that we don't have these militant organizations running roughshod over existing states and governments and erasing borders. And quite frankly, if those countries in the region would at least temporarily set aside their agreements on a host of other issues, then I think that, quite frankly, ISIS could be disposed of relatively easily. I mean, they are fierce fighters in the sense that they are quite obviously highly motivated and seem to take great pleasure in killing, but they are not a serious army.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they do not have the sort of intelligence capabilities, organization, skills, heavy weaponry that constitutes a serious military force.
Well, and Colonel, I feel that in the coverage following the November 13th attacks in Paris, that the media and certain governments have hyped the significance of the Islamic State and its real influence. For example, buried in a lengthy Sunday story this past week in the New York Times about how the Islamic State has established control of the coastal town of Sirte in Libya. The article buried an item of how it is not that intelligence officials do not believe that there was an order from Raqqa delivered to the affiliate that appears to have shot down the Russian airliner a few weeks back. And so I think that there is this hype that, you know, expands the fear profile, but in fact is not based in evidence that there is a central command and control that, you know, calls up and says, hey, why don't you guys take out an airliner on Tuesday?
I think you're exactly right. It's, I mean, one can make the same point with regard to Al-Qaeda. When Al-Qaeda was riding high, we had the emergence of these several Al-Qaeda affiliates, and that made it look, it gave the appearance, therefore, that Osama bin Laden, you know, hidden away in his in wherever he was at the time, was somehow orchestrating a coordinated Al Qaeda campaign that extended across several countries. That seems not to be what was actually happening. What was happening was that local militant organizations, wanting to acquire greater credibility and stature and standing and call attention to themselves, started calling themselves Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that to some degree that's what's going on right now. ISIS has been riding high. They have eclipsed Al-Qaeda as the principal agents of jihad. And so it's not surprising if local militant groups in other places suddenly declare that they're part of ISIS. And when the media then, you're correct, I think, when the media picks up on that, the effect then is to really serve the purposes of ISIS by buying into this notion of a great integrated, coordinated movement. It's really a little bit like long ago in the Cold War, when the perception of monolithic communism was everywhere and became the basis for policy. Became the basis for demagoguery, and we know now, and we should have known then, that different communist parties or different communist-controlled governments collaborated in some respects, and in other respects had different interests. Monolithic communism never existed, and I don't think there's a monolith of Islamic radicalism either.
And, Colonel, the same article I referred to suggested that this buildup in Libya, where we created a vacuum, and the article mentioned that NATO took out Gaddafi, but really didn't mention the U.S. role. They paint a picture that this is a, like a fallback plan, and that this could be where they would regroup to if they are eradicated from Iraq. And today, on Wednesday, there's an article in the Times which says that, you know, the popularity of the Islamic State is ebbing because of their brutal tactics, and they can't really run a government and stuff like that. My feeling is that these articles are based on a kind of wishful thinking that this foe is in decline. And despite the 8,000 airstrikes that the U.S. has launched in the last 14 months, and they have lost a little bit of territory, they really don't seem to be declining, in my view.
I don't know. And again, one would have to have access to some serious intelligence. I think it's a plausible argument that ISIS will overreach. Much as, for example, Al-Qaeda in Iraq overreached, that the brutality that enables you to cow people into subservience at some point doesn't work anymore, that it begins to elicit resistance. Whether or not that's happening now with ISIS, as some of these press reports suggest. I don't know if it's true. Maybe it is wishful thinking, but it is at least a plausible possibility. Again, emphasizing, you know, early on we were talking about what are the options, and one of the options, in a sense, is to let ISIS defeat itself through its own excesses. Now, that's an option that means that you're going to have the people who are currently under the control of ISIS be the bill payers, and there's a pretty good moral question about, you know, whether that's permissible. But we need more information than we have to know whether that could possibly play out.
Colonel, I know your time is tight here today, and I want to ask you about one more thing. In my introduction, I mentioned that you had served in Vietnam. And in mid-October, you published a piece at Tom Dispatch where you used the phrase Vietnamization 2.0. Please describe for my listeners here what you see in comparative terms about Vietnam and the Middle East today.
The point of the piece was to recall that when the U.S. got tired of fighting in Vietnam and we decided we were going to leave, Richard Nixon initiated a program called Vietnamization, which said we're going to turn the fight back to the Vietnamese. And the idea was that we would be able to build up the South Vietnamese army to the point where it could be able to manage the fight, and that turned out to be unsuccessful. And to some degree, we're engaged in a similar project now, particularly in Iraq, but also with the Syrian resistance to Assad. And the evidence, at least available to us publicly, suggests that we're not doing much better training these foreign armies today than we did when we were trying to train the South Vietnamese. And therefore, the bottom line is one needs to be a little bit realistic in terms of estimating our capability to build foreign armies.
Well, and the debacle of the past year is we authorized up to $500 million to train so-called moderates, and there was a total washout at the end. Ashton Carter had to admit that, well, maybe four fighters surfaced at a cost of $9 million a man.
Right.
And now,
to the extent that ISIS has any heavy weapons, it's weapons of American manufacture that they captured from the Iraqis.
Yeah, and now they've announced a new moderate group called the New Syrian Army. Letters are NSA. They could have picked something else. But, this is a story that kind of has a Groundhog Day sensibility to it.
A little bit, it does.
Yeah. Well, Colonel, thank you for your comments and for your time today. I always appreciate talking with you.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Andrew Basevich here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for listening to this conversation with Andrew Basevich. I welcome your comments and feedback. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until